The only weapon we have to oppose the bad effects of technology is technology itself. There is no other. We can't retreat into a non-technological Eden, which never existed. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, 35,786 kilometers below the Clark Belt in London, Ontario, Canada. We humans have been a spacefaring species now for 55 years. In that time, many nations have launched diverse spacecraft for myriad reasons. Some provide us with localization abilities. Others observe our weather and monitor our changing Earth. Still others permit nearly instantaneous worldwide communication, and many, many more are derelicts. However, what they all have in common is that they are all up there, occupying space and susceptible to collision as their numbers increase. It doesn't take much to damage a satellite. Orbital speeds are so great that anything larger than a centimeter can do irreparable harm, and it is estimated that there are approximately 500,000 such objects swarming through the skies. The largest 21,000 of these, those larger than 10 centimeters, are actively tracked. Luckily, the thin atmosphere at low Earth orbit means that many of these objects re-enter the atmosphere and are therefore cleared. But with increasing altitude comes increasing longevity. The higher an object is, the longer it will remain. This problem is especially acute for the valuable geostationary orbits where, effectively, debris remains indefinitely. The safe operation of space vehicles and satellites depends on understanding this debris environment, mitigating and shielding the effects of potential impacts, and if possible, taking active steps to clean up the junk that exists. These topics have been the subject of Dr. Mark Matney of the Orbital Debris Program Office at the NASA Johnson Space Center. The critical work of this office emphasizes our opening quote tonight by C.P. Snow and the importance of coming together as an international community to assume stewardship of Earth's orbital space. Our own Dave Kirsch sat down with Dr. Matney in London this past May, appropriately for the dynamics of such objects. Transitioning us tonight is Vangelis's Kinematic.
Dr. Matney, thank you very much for coming out today and speaking with us here at Western Worlds.
I'm good to be here.
Today we're going to be talking about space debris. To begin with, let's talk about what sort of space debris is up there. How many pieces of debris?
Well, that's actually a complicated question, but let's first define what space debris is. Actually, the international community calls it space debris. We at NASA often call it orbital debris, but it's basically human-made objects in space that no longer serve a useful purpose. And as I tell people sometimes, every mission in space is destined to become orbital debris because every piece of equipment reaches a point in its life where it's no longer useful. Now, in terms of numbers, it's a complex question. Because it's a function of size. The U.S. Space Surveillance Network tracks of order 30,000 objects. I don't have the exact numbers at my fingertips. It actually changes over time as there are more and less objects in space. Now, they can see things down to about 10 centimeters in size in low Earth orbit. And when I say low Earth orbit for this discussion, we generally think of things below about 2,000 kilometers altitude. But we know from our own measurements and from a variety of modeling that there are a number of objects smaller than 10 centimeters. But the 10 centimeter objects are the objects we can see. And track. And track means that you see it today, you know where it's going, and you can predict where it'll be tomorrow. But we know there's a lot of stuff. It's like an iceberg. We see the tip of the iceberg, and there's a lot of stuff smaller than that that we can't see.
Are there estimates of tens of millions of small things?
Yes, as you go down in size, it gets into the hundreds of thousands at the centimeter size and on up into the millions when you get into the millimeter size. And keep in mind that the thing we're worried about is what damage can it do? And it turns out a 1 centimeter object will damage almost every operational spacecraft in orbit. So 1 centimeter is bad.
And those are the things we can't really
track
down.
And typically 1 millimeter does not do significant damage. So the actual danger size is between those two extremes, a 1 millimeter and 1 centimeter.
In particular, they're dangerous because they're moving so fast, right?
That's right. Okay. The orbital velocities in low Earth orbit are around 7 kilometers per second. And they're traveling all different directions. So if an object's coming in the opposite direction of you, it can be upwards of 14 or 15 kilometers per second head on. Typically, it's smaller than that, but still in the many kilometers per second regime. And at those velocities, it's the energy that drives everything. I once had a discussion with a colleague of mine, and he said, "You mean to tell me a marshmallow at those speeds would damage?" I said, "Yes, indeed, because it's the energy, not the physical constituents of the material." Of course, the kinetic energy goes up as the square of the velocity. So put it in context, a bullet from a rifle is of order 1 kilometer per second. And so we're talking about things of order 7 or 10 kilometers per second. And since the velocity is squared, we're talking about things 100 times the energy of a bullet. So you can get some idea of the kind of damage it can do.
Far more dangerous than a gun range up there.
Yes,
indeed. And these things just keep going around.
They just keep going
with chances at impacts.
Yeah, that's what keeps them in orbit is their speed. They're falling around the Earth at high velocity. And like I said, they're in multiple different planes. So you can get them from the side, you can get them from the front, you can get them from the rear. It's a pretty busy place up there. But keep in mind that space is still quite big. It's just not quite as big as people thought a long time ago.
And these particles or small chunks of satellite or whatever it may be, they stay up there for a very long time, right? There's nothing in particular to bring them down unless they go skim the Earth's atmosphere.
That's actually a complex story too, because it depends on the altitude. We have an atmosphere. Here on the Earth, it's quite thick, fortunately. As you know, as you go up higher in altitude, the atmosphere gets thinner and thinner. Up at space station altitudes, which is about 300 or 400 kilometers altitude, the drag is actually quite strong. And objects released, for instance, from the space station typically re-enter in a few months. But as you go up in altitude, the orbital lifetimes get longer. So at about 600 kilometers altitude, which is a little bit higher than the Hubble Space Telescope, things can last tens of years in orbit. As you get up to near 1,000 kilometers altitude, things can last 100 years in orbit before they decay naturally from atmospheric drag. And as you get up higher than that, they can last even longer. Objects out at geosynchronous orbit, which is 36,000 kilometers, that's the orbits that your satellite dishes communicate with, those will essentially be there forever for all intents and purposes. They are stable orbits.
And that junk is endangering our television.
That's right. That is high interest territory, we'll say. But the problem is, if you think about it in a physics problem, you have sources and sinks. And our source is we're launching things into orbit. In low Earth orbit, the sink is drag. At geo, there's no sink. So you don't have to be a PhD in physics to know if you have a bathtub that you're filling with water and you haven't pulled the sink, it's eventually going to overflow and you're going to have problems. And fortunately, at geo, there's a lot of space and it's a long-term problem, but we will eventually have to deal with the problem at geo.
And every time something collides, it just creates more debris.
That's correct. And the busiest place is low Earth orbit. And every time objects collide, especially large objects, they could create debris. Now, up until a few years ago, the primary driver was not collisions, it was explosions. Because it turns out early in the space age, launching states would use upper stages. They would put their spacecraft in orbit and they would leave the upper stage in orbit. They still do to some extent. But oftentimes there would be some residual propellant because the engineers always design a little extra. And what people didn't realize and took some time to inform the community, you know, as you know, a rocket is a controlled explosion. Well, if you leave fuel on board, we found that maybe a week or a month or a year or a decade later, they would spontaneously explode because they weren't designed to upper
stage. Actually completely fragment or just vent?
Sometimes they vent, but oftentimes they fragment with hundreds of pieces. And so we basically were having grenades, if pardon the expression, exploding in low Earth orbit. And we've had more than 100 such explosions in Earth orbit in general since the beginning of the space age. And so a lot of the work that was done in orbital debris in the early years was just informing people, letting them understand this is an issue. And so now all the spacefaring nations are moving in directions where they vent the propellants, they get rid of energy sources when they abandon an object in orbit. We've seen some success in that direction. For instance, a number of spacecraft have been redesigned so that they won't explode, that they do vent their energy sources. That was the first step in mitigating orbital debris is to do no harm.
To stop adding to it.
But it turns out it's a little more complicated than that. But that was our first big successes. And it was interesting. Once we told the engineers what was happening, they were like, oh, okay, we can fix that problem. But they just didn't know.
So it was simple enough to just vent the fuel? It didn't create an additional cost?
It was some cost. And it was some issue. But I think they realized it was a self-interest kind of thing. Nowadays, a number of spacecraft are designed specifically with that in mind. I believe the Ariane 5 was the first rocket specifically specifically designed from the beginning to vent its propellants when it's completed.
So among all the small and large things that are flying around up there, how much threat is posed to the astronauts in particular who would travel through it?
Again, it's a complicated question. Astronauts are susceptible to debris. In fact, human spacecraft are themselves probably some of the more sensitive spacecraft because you have a pressurized compartment. You only takes one hole to cause a bad problem. They're sensitive, depending on the spacecraft, to actually relatively small sizes. Fortunately, almost all human missions take place beneath the vast majority of debris. So we're actually in a relatively quiet regime, but that doesn't mean it's the probability is zero. It turns out that the space station, the International Space Station, was the first spacecraft designed specifically with orbital debris in mind. It actually has armor, has shielding, and in many places it can shield up to 1 centimeter in size, which turns out to be a pretty impressive engineering feat. The astronauts aboard the space station are in a relatively safe structure. And we know that there have been impacts on the space station already.
So we've seen the results. The armor is fairly dinged up.
Yes, we actually have cases where it's pretty clear that if we had a thin wall, we would have already had problems. So that's good that we put the armor on there. The space shuttle itself was actually quite vulnerable to space debris. The thermal protection system on the shuttle was vulnerable to damage from space debris. And if you recall, the later missions, they always did an inspection after launch because they were concerned about launch debris.
They would fly backwards, right?
They would fly backwards to kind of shield the sensitive surfaces because there were certain surfaces that were more sensitive than others. But they also actually did a late inspection. They were looking for debris damage from orbital debris. Fortunately, we had no more problems. But just to give an example, every mission, especially in the later years, the shuttle program, had damage to the windows sufficient that the windows had to be replaced.
Every mission?
Every mission. Wow. On average, one or two windows were replaced per mission.
And that's an extremely visible impact.
You're familiar with the ding on your car window.
I've rocks flying off the windshield before. It's always uncomfortable.
It's the same phenomenon, except in this case, these were tiny particles, and in some cases, they were bits of paint or tiny bits of metal, much, much smaller than what does damage on your car. But again, fortunately, we didn't lose any crews.
Has anything large ever made it down through the atmosphere to Earth?
Oh, yes. That's another whole aspect of orbital debris is reentry risk. Perhaps the most famous reentering object was Skylab, if you remember that during the 70s. Came down over Australia. The interest in reentering debris has been growing over the years, and there's actually a concerted effort on the part of the international community to encourage space users that if they have the capability, if they have the engineering capability, to actually do controlled deorbit, deorbit the object over, say, the broad expanse of the Pacific Ocean to try and minimize the casualty risk. But there are a number of inert objects in orbit that will eventually reenter that we can't control. But I think you will begin to see more and more controlled deorbits as time goes on. For instance, the ATV, the servicing missions to the space station, do a controlled deorbit. The Progress spacecraft do controlled deorbit. So, and it's a function of how large the object is and what it's made out of. If your object is relatively small and made of aluminum, aluminum melts almost always on reentry. But oftentimes people make their spacecraft out of titanium or steel, and those materials tend to survive reentry because they have high melting points. So it's a function of what the spacecraft's made out of, how it's constructed, and the number of pieces it breaks into, and also where it lands on the surface of the Earth. So it's actually a complex problem, but there's been a lot more interest. One of the things that we've been pushing the last few years at NASA, or I should say encouraging people to do, is what we call design for demise. When you're first designing a spacecraft and you're putting things together, if the engineers know, hey, if you make it out of this metal rather than this metal, it will disintegrate upon reentry. And so they can know from the very beginning to begin designing pieces that will not survive reentry. And of course, there were several high-profile reentries just in the last few months. We had the NASA Upper Atmosphere Research Satellite, UARS, and then right on its tail was the German Rosat spacecraft. And then the Russians had their Phobos Grunt spacecraft fail on its way to Mars. It failed in low Earth orbit and reentered. You know, all of those were unfortunate events. We knew that Rosat and UARS were coming in eventually.
Were those controlled?
No, those were uncontrolled. They were both dead spacecraft. But I think what that highlights is the very international nature of orbital debris. Here we had the Germans, the Americans, and the Russians, just in a matter of months, had three high-profile reentries.
So there's no particular laws or any way to really govern what's going on up there?
Well, it turns out there is some space law. There's some UN space treaties. They mostly have to do with liability. What we have is an international group called the Interagency Debris Coordination Committee, and it's called the IADC, and it's composed of the major spacefaring nations. Let's see if I can remember who they are. Let's see. There's the U.S., there's NASA, there's the European Space Agency, ESA, there's China, Russia, Ukraine, India, Japan, and the several European nations have joined independently. There's Italy.
Is Canada in there?
That's what I was getting to. Canada has just joined. They are new members of the IADC. In fact, we just had a few days ago the first IADC meeting in Canada, and we have what we call the guidelines, and they are technical recommendations on what a good actor, a good neighbor does in space. And there are things like avoiding explosions. There are things like when you're done with a spacecraft or rocket body to remove it from the orbital debris environment in a reasonable length of time so it doesn't become a collision hazard. And one of the parts of that that is to try and move in directions that minimize the risk to people on the surface. But the guidelines are just that. They're guidelines. They're not international law. They're meant to be things that wise players do in space to be good neighbors.
In they their want own, to stay in space and continue right, and so, working up there.
And it's their own self-interest. But each of the nations has gone back and is, in fact, with their own legal structures, have put together, or in the process of putting together, rules and regulations for their own countries' space programs to abide by these guidelines. Now, the UN recently, in the last few years, has adopted a very similar version of the guidelines, much simpler version. But the principles of the IEDC have been adopted by the UN, what's called the UN Committee on the Peaceful Uses of Space, UNCOPUOS. And they defer to the IEDC as the technical experts in this field. And they're, like I said, all these different countries. And we try to come up, what are the rules of the road? And the newest thing, and maybe we'll get to this in a moment, is called active debris removal. Active debris removal, ADR. The idea being that now that we've kind of got rules about what to do when you have a new spacecraft, how do you design the mission to minimize orbital debris, it's become clear that even if we did nothing at all, if we stopped launching, collisions would still begin to dominate over time because there's a lot of mass still on orbit that's going to be up there for a long time.
The more things collide, the more debris there is, it can cause more collisions. So it
exactly.
Cascade, right?
And there's already enough stuff up there to begin that process. So it's become clear that we need to find out ways to remove what's already up there. And that turns out to be sort of the hot topic right now. And people are beginning to discuss, how do you do that in a smart way? How do you do that in a responsible way? If you can do A and not B, which is better? And you'll hear news stories about people proposing ideas. The problem is it's very expensive. And it's going to take national space agencies or perhaps international work to come up with a workable procedure. The other problem is, remember those international laws I mentioned, it is actually illegal to go up and tamper with someone else's spacecraft. Even if it's derelict, they still have responsibility for it. So there's a little bit of diplomacy that has to go on. Now, fortunately, all those member states that we're talking about are all pretty much on the same page. We need to do something. So I think you would see processes in the future where the U.S. perhaps might ask permissions of the Russians to remove an upper stage, an international regime where people could work together. And this is just one of those areas. And it's a classic environmental problem. Someone a long time ago dumped something upstream of you, and now everyone has to deal with that.
So are a lot of the defunct satellites private, or are they mostly government?
They are mostly government. It turns out the vast majority of the mass is in some upper stages. So I think the technical solution is, if you want to begin doing things quickly and efficiently, is start removing a lot of those upper stages.
The big things that could eventually
big
become
things.
Bigger problems.
And the bigger the thing that collides, the bigger the problem, the more the debris it creates. And so that's the direction we're moving. What'll actually happen remains to be seen, because like I said, it's a very expensive problem. And as with any environmental problem, cleanup is always the most expensive part.
So would it ever get to an efficient point where if you want to send something up, you have to send something down as well?
Well, I won't say it that way, but I think we're getting to the point where everything you send up, you clean up after yourself, or we're trying to move
in
that direction.
So there is an exit strategy for everything that goes up now.
Right. And then all we have to do is clean up what's already up there, and we can hopefully keep things under control. I don't think we'll ever get rid of orbital debris. It's just the nature of the environment and the use we use of it, but we can keep it in manageable proportions.
So to get rid of something, does it have to be deorbited, or can it be sent to a higher orbit?
There are both. Ideally, we'd like to deorbit it because, again, it mostly disintegrates in the atmosphere, with the exception of toxic materials, which there's not very many. There's a few reactors up there with radioactive material. But for the most part, reentering is over uninhabited stretches of ocean is the ideal, but you can't always do that. For the short term, there are what we call graveyard orbits, places you can put them for now, which they won't be a problem for a very long time to come. But even then, ultimately, we're going to have to deal with the graveyard orbits. But hopefully that's hundreds of years down the road when the technology will be such that we can more easily deal with them. Right now, we're kind of looking on a time scale of decades. How can we do things so that 30 or 40, 50 years from now, the space environment will still be relatively benign?
So in order to bring something down that wasn't planned on coming down, you have to send a mission to go get it, a satellite or a robotic?
Well, that's one of the ideas, is a space tug that goes and gets it. But it turns out it's hard to do that. They're traveling so fast, you have to rendezvous. I think there are issues of kind of space tugs that have tricks where they use the deorbiting of one object to give them a boost to go to the others. There are space tethers that use electromagnetic forces to deorbit. People have even talked about things like space lasers. The problem with space lasers is they look a little bit too much like weapons in space, so that tends to get people nervous. So, I mean, there's lots of ideas. So far, we haven't found the silver bullet, and there may not be a silver bullet. We may have to just do it the old-fashioned engineering way. But I think there's a lot of excitement and hope that we can can be doing some of this in the relatively near future.
How do the lasers work in particular? Are they designed to probably not destroy, but to sap momentum from the
debris? I think the idea is they're specifically typically talk about lasers in terms of small debris, where you zap them on the front and you get superheating on the front, which causes a bit of the material to evaporate and actually cause a little jetting in the reverse direction. It's like a retro fire. And the idea is if you keep doing that, you can drop them into lower orbits where the atmosphere can finish the process. I think on paper, it can work, but I think probably the hurdles may be insurmountable on that. What's scary is any of the active debris removal options are themselves could be considered by someone as a space weapon.
Yeah, they can all take care of satellites.
Anytime you can do anything to a satellite, it makes people nervous. So like I said, this has to be an international process and a very open and transparent one in order for it to be generally accepted.
Now, there have been anti-satellite weapons.
Yes, there have.
In space.
There have. It turns out that if you can do your anti-satellite weapon that destroys, typically they've been trying to destroy the spacecraft. If you do your test low enough, the debris is short-lived. What happened, though, in 2007 is the Chinese did a test at high altitude. And as you know, that created an international furor, I should say, because the debris from that test is going to be up, some of it, 100 years from now. So it has actually greatly increased the orbital debris at that altitude. And then following in the footsteps of that 2 years later in 2009, we had the first of the large collisions that we've been expecting for a long time. That was the Iridium-Cosmos collision.
And active satellites?
Iridium was active. The Russian Cosmos spacecraft was actually derelict.
But neither had the ability to move out of the way?
Well, that's a very complicated issue. The Iridium spacecraft did, but it wasn't clear that they had enough information to actually avoid the collision. As an aftermath of that collision, there is a great deal more interest in what's called collision avoidance. And the big game in town for collision avoidance is the U.S. Space Surveillance Network, part of the old NORAD system, which Canadians are familiar with. They're the ones that track all those objects in space. And we have moved into a realm now where the Space Surveillance Network, the JSPOC, the Joint Space Operations Center, will actually provide collision warnings to any of the space users now in space. That means international. So we have our international colleagues are getting warnings now regularly from the JSPOC. And it's all as a result of that event. I think there's much more interest now in avoiding having collision. But still, that's only a small fraction of the satellites. I think in that one, it's everyone wants to keep their particular operational spacecraft safe. But it's only a piece of the puzzle because the vast majority of objects up there can't be controlled and can't maneuver.
When the debris is being tracked, what sort of estimates on the distance between satellites can they nail down to?
Well, it depends on, of course, how far into the future you're tracking, because as you make a measurement, there are uncertainties as you project out in the future. And atmospheric drag is a big uncertainty, at least at space station altitudes. You don't know if this solar activity is going to make the atmosphere a little more dense or a little. It varies quite dramatically over short time periods. As the solar activity changes, the atmosphere can expand and cause more drag, or it can cool and contract and cause less drag. I think what we've seen really as a result of the work that was done with the shuttle and the space station is the Joint Space Operations Center not only generates positions downrange, but they try to generate uncertainties. And this is ongoing work, but they're trying to give a probability that the object will hit. And we have probability thresholds. When the probability gets above a certain threshold, that's when you decide to do a maneuver. I believe with the space station, it's 1 in 10,000 probability of collision was when they try to do a maneuver to get out of the object. I don't know what the numbers are for the individual robotic missions, but they have similar thresholds that they don't maneuver unless it reaches a certain probability, and then they maneuver. So the answer is that they're giving you a range in meters, but there's a rather large uncertainty. And sometimes
space is pretty large.
Well, it's just
there are 30,000 things.
That's right. But you actually can get conjunctions of objects. The minimum distance is of order of tens of meters on occasion. But because there's some uncertainty in where that is, because they're moving so fast, if you've got very small errors in the velocity, you can get a large mini tens up to hundreds of meters downrange errors, even only a few hours out. So there's a probability envelope that defines the collision probability with your asset.
And if the atmosphere makes that more complicated than when you're deorbiting something, how much more uncertain is the landing location?
When you're actually actively deorbiting, you can control where it is because you try to place it so the perigee brings it down in a very specific region. But when it's uncontrolled, like UARS or ROSAT or Phobos Grunt, there's a great deal of uncertainty because you don't know, even at the very end, you don't know which orbit it's coming in on. So it's coming in on this orbit plus or minus one or two or three orbits. Well, in a single orbit, it circles the entire Earth. So
it's a big range.
It's a big range. Now, sometimes you can block out certain regions, say, well, it's not going to come in this hemisphere, in this over North America or over Europe. But towards the end, it's always a big uncertainty where it's actually going to come in, depending on a lot of factors. And hence, all the media frenzy that grows up around those reentries, because they want to know which city it's coming down over them. That's very difficult to pinpoint.
Since debris can be relatively dangerous, of course, and maybe inconvenient, is there any way that it could be turned to a positive use? Could it be mined up there, or could empty booster rockets be used as a habitat?
Well, people have talked about things like that, and I think there are people interested, but I think it's just in the thought process. There is a lot of material in space, and in principle, let's say at geosynchronous, you could go up there, harvest the materials, reprocess them, and refurbish spacecraft. It's not clear. I mean, obviously, it's an engineering possibility, but the question is...
It's not easy to work in space.
It's not easy to work in space, and would it be cost-effective? I mean, certainly, that's an option, but, you know, I think at this point, it's just people's ideas. It'll be interesting to see in the coming decades what people do with it.
Now, you mentioned that it is difficult to do any sort of deorbiting procedure on something that's not already controlled, but that it might be easier in the future. So, is it easier, or is it cheaper or better to do it now, when it's still difficult, or to wait until our technology is maybe more capable of handling these tasks?
Well, we have a little bit of time. It's not like it's immediately urgent that we take care of it, but it's something we need to be working towards. We were talking about the process where you get collisions which cause more collisions, and that's termed the Kessler syndrome. Don Kessler was my first boss at NASA. He's now retired. And he actually got that idea from the kinds of breakups that occur in the natural solar system with asteroids and specifically with planetary rings, where you end up with a collision that creates lots of debris and that causes more collisions and eventually end up with a ring-like structure. The only difference is with orbital debris, there's a very long time scale. The time between collisions can be many decades. But nevertheless, once this process starts, if you don't do anything about it, it will continue in the long run.
And so, you mentioned that we might already be over that threshold.
There are certain regimes in low Earth orbit where the density is already high enough that the collisions will create more debris faster than it is physically removed by drag. So yes, we've started a chain reaction, but again, we have time. It's not like we have to take care of it right now. The chain reaction will affect things 50, 100, 150 years down the road. But now is the time to be thinking about doing things and starting to develop technologies. Just to give you an example of one of the engineering problems, let's say you decided to remove a rocket body. Well, rocket bodies, it's uncontrolled. It's a big upper stage. It probably tumbles. So you have to rendezvous with it, figure out a way to grab hold of it, figure out a way to unrotate it, and then bring it in safely, hopefully over the ocean. It turns out that those are difficult problems to do. This is a big multi-ton object.
A bunch of different difficult problems.
And one of the things that we're doing right now, just a simple question. How many of these rocket bodies tumble? So people are doing optical observations on these tracked objects to figure out, do they tumble? And there's some anecdotal evidence that they spin up and spin down. So they may not be in a single state all the time. Because there are various forces that work on solar radiation pressure, atmospheric drag, that can cause them to behave in odd ways. And then where do you grab hold of them? They aren't designed to be grabbed hold of. They're not like the Hubble Space Telescope with a big grapple fixture on the side. So it turns out to be a very interesting engineering problem. And plus, you have multiple different countries that build multiple different spacecraft and rockets, and no two are alike. It's an intriguing problem. The engineers love it because they get to come up with new and interesting ways of doing things. But rotation tends to be a really big problem. Surprisingly simple thing is surprisingly difficult to solve.
Okay, so just to wrap up, what do you think the prospects are for the future? Are we going to be starting to eliminate this problem or decrease it, or is it just going to stand still for a little while?
I'm very hopeful. I wouldn't be in the field if I wasn't hopeful. As I tell people, I'm in a booming business. There's no lack of things to do. I think what I'm seeing now, perhaps, because I've been working in this field for 20 years now, I think what I'm seeing now more than ever before is a general consensus growing on the international community that the various state actors are willing to put forth resources to actually do proactive things in space. And there remains to be seen if that continues, but if that continues, I think there's a lot of hope that we will begin seeing active cleanup in space. And also in the process, we understand the environment much, much better than we have before, and we're understanding the sources. And step by step, we're making efforts to try and inform actors in space what they're doing and not doing that makes things better and makes things worse. And the other thing, I think we're seeing countries realizing this is everybody's job, and we're seeing the countries beginning to act more and more responsibly. It's still a long road to go, and we're by no means done, but I think there's almost like a critical mass that everybody agrees that something needs to be done, and that's a good sign, a hopeful sign. And like I said, it's a very international, eclectic group of orbital debris scientists, but we're all kind of going in the same direction. That's a good sign.
Good. Thank you again for coming out to talk with us.
Pleased to be here, and it's my first time to this region of the continent, and I'm enjoying it very much.
Good. Have fun.
Thank you.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
We just heard from Dr. Mark Matney all about space debris and how it continues to be an issue and possibly a growing issue, but that we are learning to deal with it and mitigate it.
He talked a great deal about being a good neighbor and planning ahead, launching spacecraft with plans to deal with the ways of generating debris. There's stuff on orbit that we still haven't really figured out how to clean up yet.
And there are still a number of unexploded boosters, which are simply ticking time bombs that haven't vented their fuel, that were launched before this protocol was put in place, which could significantly up the amount of debris in their orbits.
And anytime anything large gets hit, it could fragment and produce a much larger pile of debris, and this obviously is a situation that can spiral.
This concept of the Kessler syndrome, which he didn't really get into in depth, where it becomes a chain reaction. The debris cloud creates more debris, which creates a larger debris cloud, which hits something else until you've entirely wiped out your orbital infrastructure.
Yeah, I don't know if Kessler likes having his name associated with that eventuality.
Not only do you wipe it out, but you can't launch anything there either. Because yeah, it there's becomes off so limits. Much yeah. stuff you
yeah,
can.
Yeah, there becomes a kind of critical mass, which is basically impossible to operate in low Earth orbit.
Some of these orbits are extremely useful to us as well. Yes. Not just transfer orbit.
Well, and that's the other thing. And we talked about high interest real estate up at GEO. This is one of the spots. There's also areas in low Earth orbit. The sun synchronous regime around 800 kilometers is very useful and very popular. If you start breaking up spacecraft in that orbit, it'll make a real mess for everybody.
And the idea is in some orbits that we've already reached that critical density, that critical number of things, it might actually be, if we don't do anything, something that would naturally at this point spiral out of control.
Yeah, and if we haven't got there yet, we're on track to, even if we don't launch anything, right? Just from fragmentation and things colliding with each other.
But as long as the objects are still large in size, like a booster or something that can be maneuvered away as opposed to a billion tiny fragments, then there is still plenty of hope.
Yeah, and the ISS every now and then has to sidle around.
The shuttle, most satellites.
Not every spacecraft has the maneuvering ability, and you don't want to waste propellant.
Yeah, certainly the ISS would not be able to do this if it wasn't regularly resupplied with hydrogen. If it didn't get refueled, they would only have a few burns worth of dodging before they exhausted the maneuvering thrusters.
If the ISS is not refueled, it will not stay on orbit for more than a few months.
This is true.
They're spending part of their propellant budget avoiding debris. He talked about how it is armored, but it's much better to avoid collisions. And the armor will only deal with maybe a centimeter in some places.
The way the armor is constructed, it's not solid plate. We couldn't send that into orbit.
No, it yields. Eventually run out as its impact.
This is layers of foil, which ablate. And ablate means vaporize. Which means they're not there next time in that one tiny spot. And so eventually, yes, the armor is going to wear out.
It means a lot of regular shimmying around for everything up there. But the problem is, they don't know perfectly the paths of all these objects that are flying around. If you know it's coming vaguely at you and you move a little bit to the left, it could be you just moved into its path.
There is uncertainty, right? How to fix or improve the environment. Schemes that have been dreamed up, none of which has been brought to a level of being practical.
Well, they're all very costly, and sometimes it's been proposed that private businesses, if they want to send stuff up, would have to take stuff down with them. Obviously, nations are going to have to deal with this, at least on some level. And then exactly how you bring it down or toss it out into a garbage orbit.
It's really complicated. If you want to propose this kind of quid pro quo thing where if you're allowed to have a launch license, you have to bring some trash back with you, basically completely impractical to deorbit something that is not in a very similar orbit to the one you're launching into.
Yeah, you have to go catch it first.
Yeah, you would essentially have to. So if you're launching a commsat, you would be taking down one in that slot in geosynchronous.
Even somewhere else in GEO, but you can't take something from a GPS orbit if you're going to GEO. In low Earth orbit, the propellant cost of changing planes or altitudes to try and grab some junk and then deorbit it, comparable to the entire cost of putting the thing in orbit in the first place.
Yeah, it's a big task. I think to bring it out into a garbage orbit.
They're easier from GEO. To get all the way from LEO out into somewhere where it's not going to be a problem is a tremendous...
Yeah, from LEO, it's probably the atmosphere. Yeah.
Haven't we learned from being on Earth? Throw our garbage somewhere else because there's going to be a problem then later.
Well, that seems to me to be the problem with the idea of a graveyard.
Oh, it's,
well, it's like, well, isn't that going to be a problem?
In some ways, it's beneficial. So we're parking high-grade resources where they're going to be not too hard to get to, as opposed to plunging them into the bottom of the Pacific.
Or vaporizing them in the atmosphere. There's a huge energy cost going from 30,000 kilometers to 300. You can do the mass times G times H and the speed. To try and plunge something from GEO into the atmosphere is very expensive.
You have a lot of momentum to kill, which is why I love an idea which he mentioned briefly, which is these electromagnetic tethers.
Yeah, it's interesting.
Any conductor working that spins in a magnetic field is either going to be a generator or it's going to be a motor, depending on which way current is flowing through it. The Earth has a magnetic field. The minute you throw up a long wire and you pass current through it, you have an electric motor, which can then be used to deorbit or push into a higher orbit. And so suddenly you have a space tug, which needs no fuel. The only problem with this is that, one, the currents required tend to melt the tethers, and two, the tethers are very vulnerable to, ironically enough, orbital debris.
Mm-hmm.
And so the biggest problem, at least in the experiments I've seen, is that they don't last very long if you simply have a long cable.
And this is a process that would take some time to sap all that momentum.
There are some real engineering difficulties with that, and it probably won't work with spacecraft that are already on orbit.
No, you would have to have some sort of very flexible grabbing...
Yeah, you could lasso them.
You would have to have some kind of lasso, but then you would have to have a counterweight to handle that, and then... To handle the balance of any... It would have to be purpose-built to bring down each individual satellite.
Yeah, let's just shoot them down with lasers.
That would be much cheaper in the long run than building a specialized grabbing robot for each one.
We have to talk about schemes that are at the boundaries of what is practical or imaginable. It's very difficult.
This is a prime example of one of those things where we did something and then we're like, oh, wait, we need some rules.
Well, you know, it's like the orbital space around the Earth. It's not unlike the atmosphere. It's just sort of suffering from the tragedy of the commons. Since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution, we were putting all kinds of emissions from steam engines and whatnot up into the air because the atmosphere was so big that it could just disappear into the huge void. Turns out that's not true.
But space is so big.
Space is enormously big, but there's only a finite amount of it next to the planet.
Yeah, there's certain
the
parts
valuable
of space.
Orbits.
Yeah, the 800 kilometers SSO, they keep putting spacecraft there because that's a great place to put them. The geostationary belt is going to be more and more of an issue. One of the matters that continues to be a problem is spacecraft in geo. Usually they're big, expensive telecommunications spacecraft. They're very valuable. They're making money every hour that they're operating. And no one wants to shut them down before they're broken. But if you want to avoid having a broken 5-ton spacecraft drifting through the geobelt, you actually have to cut it off at some point and say, all right, we're done. We're going to use the propellant that's on board to boost it into the
orbit. Yeah, you have to kill it while it's alive.
Fortunately, a good percentage use the same bus. If we were to conceive such as MDA's servicing robot, which was in the news a while back, where their plan was to refuel or boost.
Yeah, and in fact, there's a robotic refueling experiment happening as we're recording this on the ISS. This will not always work. It may be a solution in some cases, and that will extend the life of some spacecraft. You have this good neighborly decision that you have to make.
Between many countries, businesses.
For a telecom provider, just have to accept that you will lose part of the utility of that spacecraft to reboost it. And then you have to make sure that there's propellant on board and that the thing is controllable. Because the things that allow you to control spacecraft, like reaction wheels, also tend to wear out. There's a lot of planning to preserve the common resource of useful orbital.
If we let it get a lot worse, then we won't be able to have any of these things. And I like my satellite TV.
Yeah.
I don't want to lose it to space debris.
Well, I like my weather pictures. And we won't have this without geostationary and polar orbiting spacecraft. We need to learn to mitigate the debris that we generate as we continue to launch and operate spacecraft. And we do, I would say, need to start looking at schemes for improving the environment. Because as he says, there are sources, but there are no sinks. And we need to start sinking some of that debris.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Dave Kirsch. Our roundtable discussion featured co-host Dave Kirsch, Raymond Francis, Tyler August, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Dave Kirsch, Michelle Parsons, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on Astronomy.fm.